Well, let's start by going into our bodies. So everybody close your eyes. Slow down your breath. Slow and deepen. Make sure you're breathing from the diaphragm. And I'm going to invite you to do today to do an open mouth breath. It doesn't have to be wide open, but you just open it a little bit and let your tongue rest on the bottom of your mouth. Yours has a very different character to it. As we slow our breath down, we come into the body. Just notice the effect that the breath has on the body. With the eyes closed, your attention automatically turns inward. You feel the coolness in your mouth and partway down your throat before the body warms it up. Expansion and contraction. It's the same as the heartbeat. Your stomach expands and contracts. The universe expands and contracts. And now extend your attention out and just kind of take in the whole body as this flow of energy. Don't name it. I'll have to use the term to point to it, but you don't name it. Don't conceptualize it. Just experience it. Like you're a little kid. Has no language, no past experience. Everything is pure sensation. You might find this to be a bit of a struggle, because we're so used to conceptualizing. We're so enculturated in thinking. So all the subtlety and often intensity of this experience of form is often simply not experienced. So try to stay present with it. If you're experienced at this, see if you can let go even more into the pure experience of it. Notice that it's effortless. You're not doing anything. You're just sitting. Watching. There is absolutely nothing you need to do, which can often be quite irritating to the mind. There's nothing to figure out. Nothing to be known. Nothing to be attained. All of those are ideas concept overlaid on this pure experience. Notice that it's not static. There's a sense of motion about it. Every single part of your body has a unique feel to it, an energetic signature. Your index finger feels very different than the thumb. You can identify them without any words whatsoever. You can actually even feel the space in between your fingers. There's a feeling to what we call form. But notice that the feeling doesn't really have a form. Not like the visual. It's a kind of a flow. Also notice that it never, ever stops. Now, as your attention goes more deeply into it, things can come up. Various kinds of emotions can come up. Sensations can come and go. Just say yes to whatever comes. This yes is the Buddha mind. All resistance is in our thinking about things. Notice there's no resistance in the body itself. It doesn't say no to anything. It's totally responsive. Right now, it's behaving and responding differently than it was before we started this meditation, because it's now in a different environment. There is no disconnect between the experience of the body, the experience of the environment that it's in. They're not two. Let your attention settle in a little bit more and just notice the awareness of the body. It appears to something. All this motion that's coming and going. There's something or someone to whom it is all appearing. Can't actually see it. So anything you see appears to it. So just notice. Notice that it's there. Unlike everything that appears to it, it isn't moving. It isn't a vibration. It doesn't have an energetic signature. It is qualitatively different than everything else. Just watch that. And now notice that even though it has no real qualities, it's totally still, you can't perceive it, yet you know it's there. There's no need to name it or try to do anything with it, because it's just there. It's just present. Even the very subtle sense of your own being is being watched by this. So if you cannot perceive it, and yet you are there, this awareness must be you. And the perceiving is not one thing perceiving another. But awareness aware of itself. And with the presentation of that, the mind will struggle, almost certainly. Because the mind can't go here. It has no conception of one. It is incapable. It always has to have two. And so it will attempt to make an awareness of all phenomena and something else that is aware. Like awareness is an attribute of something. But that something would have to appear to awareness. So awareness is what you are. This is your true nature. This is the Buddha. This is pure consciousness. This is the no self. It has no characteristics, no attributes, no anything. Except that it is. This is what is. Everything else is an appearance that comes and goes. And that appearance, when it is regarded as something other, it's called samsara. When it is seen as simply the flow, the substance of which is awareness, that's nirvana. Same thing, seen from a different place. I am that. Now even drop all the words and just be that awareness. If your mind gets distracted, just bring it back. No big deal. It's what minds do. if any sensation arises of any kind, be it calm and joy or tension or an ache, just say yes to it. It's already there. Awareness has already said yes. An emotion shows up, something strong or light. Say yes to that. Just remain as this, abide as awareness. It is what you are. Now, as we begin to come back from this, notice that we are not actually coming back. We can't ever leave here. If you did, awareness would cease. What we're simply doing now is turning our attention back towards the external, what's called the external, which actually isn't. And letting our attention take in the phenomena. But the phenomena must always report to the awareness. Without that, there is literally nothing. And as you're doing that, just notice that this experience of the awareness, so pure, so recognizable, that it is exactly the same experience for all of us. We are all the one awareness. Now take another breath to let your attention acclimate. And gradually, as you're ready, you can open up and let more phenomena in. Loving awareness. In a meditation, we went to that place of just pure awareness. Was anybody able to just kind of be there without the mind intruding for even a split second? Anybody? Raise your hand just so I can see. Wonderful. Wonderful. This is a practice. It's a strange paradox. Because why should you need to practice what you already are? And there are several teachers and lines of thought in Advaita Vedanta that you shouldn't practice, and it is just this inquiry, which is a practice in and of itself. So it's actually an idea that falls apart pretty quickly, but it is something to ponder, isn't it? It's kind of a koan in itself. Why is there a need to practice? I've heard it said that enlightenment is an accident, but practice makes you more accident prone. Is it an accident? Is it predestined? Is it the result of good karma and merit in past lives? And what is it? What's all the big fuss about? Well, everything, when you look at everything from one point of view or another, you get stuck in that point of view. If I decide that this is the right way, that means all other ways become the wrong way. But if awareness, the substance of all existence, is in fact infinite, then it cannot be limited at all. So there can't be one side that's right and one side that's wrong. It simply can't exist. So then what are we actually practicing? Relinquishing all positions. Now, this is a tough one because, again, we're back to the paradox. We live in a world where we need to take positions. There's powerful forces at work. Income inequality is the highest it's ever been. It surpassed the Gilded Age of the United States. Global warming, just enormous cruelty, nonstop war. How can you say don't take a position on that? We have to, don't we? So is this inconsistent then? Do I need to take a position? Does that kind of negate the whole idea of not to? Well, actually not. All positions are relative. They're just a response to this particular moment. None of them are absolutely true. One could say that World War II was necessary. You could also say that that's the last war in the history of the world that actually was. The rest have all been manufactured and artificial. But there was a genuine threat in Nazi Germany and Hitler. It was a real threat, and something did have to be done about it. But has any war since been? Well, no. And of course, if that position of taking something, okay, we do need to take arms here, the moment it's no longer needed, the position is dropped. Because it's not the ideal. It's not what we're actually striving for. And so this happens. Right? Yes, I'm taking a position knowing full well that I may need to change that position at any moment, and at some point that the need for that position will be gone. We get in trouble when we get stuck in that position. And the meaning of the word that is translated into English from Sanskrit and Pali, which is where all the Buddhist texts are written in, or suffering is dukkha. And dukkha refers to the hub of a wheel that has gotten out of true and it can't turn. That the suffering, the cause of suffering, is being stuck. Stuck in an identity, stuck in a position, stuck in an attitude, stuck in belief systems, stuck in assumptions. And that's all the ego is a set of stuck assumptions. I say, this is what I am. Now, the moment I say, this is what I am, I'm stuck in it. I have created a world around it. And the power of consciousness is such that the moment I do that, the world will conform to my perception. I will see things through that lens, and therefore, the world will be exactly what I think it is. Objectively, is it? No, it isn't. But there is no objectivity. There is nothing objective. As Muji put it, there's one earth, there's 8 billion worlds. Because we're all experiencing our own perception of things. Now, there's a little known teaching from the Buddha Sorry for all my Buddha messages, because I've just been spending a lot of time with Buddhist texts lately. So it's going to be raining Buddha words around here for a bit. It's a little known teaching from the Lakavatara Sutra. And he gives what it's called four bodhisattva practices. Now, the bodhisattva, bodhi means awake, enlightened, and sattva means being. It's an enlightened being, right? Mm-hmm. Not yet a Buddha, but an enlightened being. And there's a distinct difference between what are called arhats and bodhisattvas in Buddhist tradition. The arhat is one who seeks enlightenment for themselves. I don't like this place. I want to get out of it. I want to be free from birth. Yeah. The bodhisattva is one who seeks enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. I tend to favor the latter. As you probably have pointed out, idea of loving awareness and being willing to be compassionately with other people's suffering, I tend to favor that side. Now, again, in this hierarchy that has been created, there's like 10 bodhisattva levels and the like. None of that's actually important. When you look at it closely, and even the Buddha himself says those aren't actually, they're temporary, they're transitional, they're a convention. They're a teaching mechanism. They're not absolutely the truth either. At any rate, at the level of the eighth and ninth, tenth being a Buddha, he gave these four practices. And anybody here who has a heart and wants to help all beings, wants to stop suffering, I regard you as a bodhisattva. I don't see anybody here just going up to the mountains in a hut to be by themselves to get it. I see people interacting with life, caring about others. So I'm going to give you his four practices and we can ponder them for a bit. The first is becoming adept at distinguishing the perceptions of your own mind. As I mentioned before, your world is your perceptions. End of story. So this practice of discerning, becoming adept at discerning the perceptions of your own mind, is obviously essential. What's true? What is my perception? And what is a perception except it's a conceptualization. It's a picture that begins to be drawn with assumptions about experience. Something happens in the environment, right? It hits my senses. It comes in through my senses, and immediately it becomes, all sorts of things get attached to it. Meaning, I'm afraid of it, I like it, I don't like it, it's advantage, it's not advantage, it's an opportunity, no, it's not an opportunity. All of that stuff congeals into a particular perspective or perception. So now I'm not just dealing with the raw information like we were in the meditation. I'm dealing with my perception of what just happened. Okay? And of course, my perception and your perception are going to be different. No matter how much we agree, it's going to be different. I mean, just the fact that we cannot actually look from exactly the same place, we're not going to see the same object. So when I look at a particular experience, I have a particular experience of my senses, and I see what I call a tree, the tree part is completely perception, right? Which, you know, perception then folds into what's called objects of mind. This is the five skandhas, by the way, but it's not important. And at that point, I see a tree. And now my perception is of the tree. But now if I really step back and do what Buddha recommended, which discern your own perception, the perceptions of your own mind, I realize that when I said the tree, I've just completely taken the tree out of its environment. That tree can't be there without the air, the sun, the insects, the earth, the worms in the earth, right? If you look at it, nothing can exist by itself, which means the perception is only a perception. It isn't seeing the whole picture. I mean, if you look at it, that tree is there because the universe is here. At one time, that stuff, those little atoms and stuff that make up that tree, were somewhere God knows where, you know, just in a furnace called a star. So now you and I have the wonderful convention to speak of, and we can talk about tree and this label this beautiful tree, and this it's a birch, it's oak, you know, it's a eucalyptus, but they're nothing but perceptions. Now you don't have to throw them away, right? Just know that they're a perception. Becoming adept at distinguishing the perceptions of your own mind, which means they're not true. They're not the whole picture. They're only a convention, and therefore not the truth. What is the truth of that tree? The truth of the tree is the truth of the universe. It's the truth of your finger. It's it's the truth of the eyes that are seeing it and all the mechanisms that are forming perception. There's the tree and is one with everything else. And so that's the process of discerning the perceptions of our own mind, and see how the mind projects an entire existence upon something that in fact does not exist. The tree does not exist any more than the hair on your head can exist without you. So the tree is purely a concept. And this, if you hopefully you can grasp this, that this is what Buddha meant when he said it both exists and does not exist. It does not exist inherently as itself, independent from anything else. Its existence is simply a particular perception, right, from a particular point of view. And if I realize it's just a perception and I give myself permission to move, I am not stuck. There is no dukkha. I am not suffering. The moment I grab onto that perception and turn it into an objective reality, I'm stuck. I'm stuck with this tree. I don't move anymore. And the inevitable result is suffering. Why? Because I'm going to interact with this object as if it was one thing, and I'm going to be really surprised when it turns out to be something else or doesn't behave the way I expect it to. Now, with a tree, that, you know, the consequences of that aren't much. But if you're talking about maybe somebody you live with, the consequences of that are severe. Right? All of a sudden, they don't act the way you expect them to act. What's wrong with you? What happened to you? You've changed. Right? When we do it to each other, we give each other, we project a sense of identity off of the little bit of information. And now we want to hold them in that identity. We don't let them be free. We don't recognize that our perception of somebody else in any kind of relationship is in fact just our perception. And the only way you could actually know them is to have lived their life all the way from the time that sperm hit the egg. It's the only way you could actually know them, which means you don't know them. You only know a perception of them. Now that's so freeing. It also opens up, interestingly enough, as a side note, it opens up the possibility of having a love affair for your whole life, because you could actually get a new person all the time. it could stay just like that initial chemical rush that we all love to have so much. The second bodhisattva vow practice is perceiving the non-existence of external existence. Which means there is no objective existence of anything. There is nothing out there. It is all awareness itself. It is all what they would call pure mind, Buddha mind. I mentioned it yesterday about, you know, the psychological mind and as patterns of thought and that sort of stuff. What mind is in its true essence is the capacity of awareness to manifest itself in form. As everything appears to this awareness, right? But everything appears within the awareness. And it also, it is made of the awareness. Mind is the substance of all things. It's what everything is actually made of, which means it is not separate from me. Perception goes even one further. And this takes the being adept at perceiving at discerning the perceptions of your own mind, it takes it one step further to say, what I'm perceiving doesn't exist out there at all. That the perceiving and of the object is the actual character and creation of the object. There is nothing out there. Now, we have to be careful with this because this can, without the cultivation of the bodhisattva vows to save all beings from suffering, right, this can quickly deteriorate into solipsism, where suddenly it's like, there's only me and nothing exists other than me, but that me is very much this egoic mind. Well, that doesn't exist separate from perception either. Or it can be something like, you know, it's the matrix, or people say we're confined to this particular dimension, and we're even an experiment in an AI computer of some super race. There's all sorts of ideas we can get about this, all of which revolve around the sense of a personal self. But if we look closely, we see the sense of a personal self is nothing but a perception of the entirety of what you are experiencing. It is an idea projected upon your experience. And when you look at it as no self, you realize that there isn't an entity having the experience. It is no self. There's no need to project a self on anything. The tree is not a self, is it? If it was a self, you could take it out of the ground and set it somewhere. It would be independent, and it's not. Everything is interdependent, or I like the way Thich Nhat Hanh puts it. He calls it interbeing, to the point at which point you have anything. Well, you have to zoom all the way out to the universe, the entire universe, but that's only a slice in time, isn't it? Go back 13.8 billion years, and there is no universe. Go back even further, and there was something else that contracted into it. Who knows? I hope this isn't going by everybody. Is this being digested by everyone? Yes, show of hands. No, Ursula's not getting. Okay, good. Good. I'm going to. I'll circle back. Let's just do a little little test. I want you to just pick out an object in your, wherever you are right now. I've got a cup sitting here on a, just something small, a pen, you know, something sitting on your desk, right? And I want you to just look at it for a moment. And as you're looking at it, just notice that there's a perception. There's the actual form, right? The outline of the form, which is there's this, maybe it's a notebook, it's a square thing, and it's a different color and shading than what's in the back in the background. Mm-hmm. And now you look at that and try to see it as just the pure experience of sight. Nothing extra added up. It's not a notebook. It has no meaning. Like you're a newborn kid, right? So there's the pure experience. There it is, form. Right? Form, which and the sensation, the perceiving of form, right? Before anything else has been added onto it. Your dog would look at that and there'd be no notebook there, just, but it would see exactly the same thing you did, right? So there's the perception. Now, you can see there's a distinction between that experience and then the perception where and mental concept where we start, say, it's a notebook, this is what it's for, this is its color, all of those things, right? The form, the shape, the color are all concepts. The experience came first, so what's primary is this direct experience. Now, the moment it gets out of the into the perception, we have all sorts of ideas about it. So go right back to that place before any concept had been formed for the pure experience. Is there anything in that experience, the direct experience, without thinking about it, that tells you conclusively that what you're perceiving exists separate from your perception of? We assume it. It's a concept. But is there anything in the experience itself that says that? So at least we can say, well, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, which is a huge step when you think, when you realize that the entire world, for the most part, assumes that it exists separate from my perception. Our world is based on that assumption. And yet, it doesn't take long to look at it and go, well, maybe that's not true. And that doubt is enough. You don't have to go the rest of the way and say, it only exists in my perception. We'll get there. But just the willingness to go, wow, it goes directly from the sense experience into a whole conception of it. Boom, like that. We just kind of put it in slow-mo and in reverse and went all the way back to right at the moment of pure experience. It's what Ramana Maharshi meant when he said, go back the way you came. Right back to the original experience. And you see that it's just a bunch of concepts, ideas, assumptions, and not necessarily true. So Buddha is presenting the possibility and asserting that this is part of the Bodhi mind, that it does not exist independent of your perception, that the knowing of it is the substance of it. And of course, we've all had experiences of being convinced something was the way it was, only to find out it wasn't. What this does is go all the way down to the depth of it to question the most fundamental thing there is. Not just there's something and I'm misperceiving it, but is there anything there at all? Now, this isn't a denial. This isn't to say that all of this is a big hallucination. Because obviously we experience it. We experience each other, the computer you're looking at, the notebook or the cup or whatever it was that was sitting on your desk, the sun shining. The experience is there. None of that goes away. The question is, what is it? What is it made of? Is it made of matter? Or is it made of mind? Is it conceptual, or is it consciousness itself? Is the substance of it matter or consciousness? If I assume that it exists independently of me, I have to come up with something that says, what is it made of? Well, then what is it? What is it made of? That's in fact, the 3,000 years ago, the Ionians who became the Greeks and classical analysis and subject-object split, that was the assumption. And they came up with the word matter to explain their perception of experience. And the atom being the tiniest particle in which it was made of, until it turned out not to be the tiniest particle, and they had to kind of keep going. But you can see, can anything exist outside of awareness? Now, this is a question to ponder. It's not something you can immediately go yes to. Yes or no, it can't. It's the kind of thing you say, well, how do I do that? How do I actually, can I step outside my awareness and verify its existence? Well, I can't do that, which means that its existence as an object, right, is an assumption, a universally accepted assumption. And there's no evidence for it. It's a totally unscientific assumption. And it is the ground upon which all of science is built. Does that help, Ursula? The struggle is simply because, okay, I can't see anything other than my perception of it. I don't know if it exists. The mind's going to go, oh, come on, it's got to, because it's habit. We've all been educated to see the world through those eyes. And somebody like, you know, Buddha comes along, and Christ and Krishnamurti and all the rest, and go, no, that's not what it is. That's only what we think it is. That's not actually what it really is. And isn't that what science does? Right? I mean, aren't they looking for what is? They recognize that all of this is phenomenal. You talk to a theoretical physicist and say, this does not exist. It is a temporary condensing of some objects that have come together temporarily to make that particular form, but it doesn't have an intrinsic existence. And they keep going down and down. It's made of this. This is made of these molecules, right? These molecules are made of the atoms, you made subatomic particles, and down into the quantum, and all the way down, looking for that which actually is, that's not an appearance of something else. Buddha made the same journey 2,600 years ago and came to what became known as enlightenment. Well, the third bodhisattva practice rides very significantly, or totally really, on the second, which is, I can't remember exactly how he worded it. Give me a second here. Not succumbing to the belief of causation, duration, and dissolution. Because it's all just a matter of perceiving, nothing came into existence. Nothing goes out of existence. Nothing has duration. I don't care how thinly you slice time. You'll not find anything there. This is completely mind-blowing to the mind because there's got to be something there. Well, is there anything there when you have a dream at night? It's an experience for sure. There are people there, things are happening, could even be a really fun experience. Right? Is there anything actually there? Did a creation actually take place? There was no cause. There was no duration. There was no dissolution. Nothing arose, nothing endured, nothing subsided. Today we're talking, this is pure non-duality. Right? I'm going to get back to the loving awareness in a minute, or two, or five. Because if everything is simply my perception of it, then the perception, the existence is only within my mind, which is fine. Right? But if I know that that's the case, I am free of attaching to it some kind of objective existence. If I think this is what it actually is, I'm now enslaved to it. If it exists separate from me, there's nothing I can do about it. I'm stuck with it. And if it's creating suffering for me, I'm really screwed. But if I only suffer by believing something exists when it doesn't, I've just opened the door to infinite freedom. Now, the last of these is really interesting. And he uses a phrase throughout the Lankavatara Sutra that I've never seen in any other sutras that Buddha did. And he did, I don't know, 50,000 of them in his lifetime. So the fourth bodhisattva practice, remember, these are a practice, right? So they're not, you don't just get it. You just keep going back to it. You keep going back to it. You keep going back to it. Oh, go back to that, whatever it was that was sitting on your desk, and reinforce the fact that I don't really know. How can I know whether this exists or not? I can't do it through getting into a third position and looking to see me perceiving it. I can't do that because I can't step out of my perception. So how is it that I come to know whether it does or not? Now you're thoroughly in the practice, right? Because there is a way to know, but it's simply not the way we've normally done it. But at any rate, that fourth practice is very interesting. He said, delight in the personal realization of Buddha knowledge. So all the heaviness and the intensity of the first three are now like, no, don't delight. Delight in this. Bring lightness to it. Bring a smile to it. Make it a loving engagement. He's pointing to what I call loving awareness. Matter of fact, he even said, without joy, there is no enlightenment. So it becomes something that you just become so turned on by that you want to keep going back. And it begins to just absorb your attention. Even if you don't get it, it's just like, man, I don't get this at all. But something inside goes, there's something here. It's so different. It's so, there's something here. And you end up falling in love with it. And that's really the only way I can put it. You end up falling in love with it. Now, before I open it up for questions, oh my God, I did go on, didn't I? Before I open it up for some questions, Ursula, I just want to keep bringing it back that is the side of pure non-duality. And the Lankavatara Sutra is the Sutra of Zen. It is the pure non-dual. But there's the other side of it. Because the bodhisattva the practice is for this guy, the Bodhisattva. Right? Remember, that's the one that vows to save all beings from suffering. Even being willing to be reincarnated over and over again just to save beings from suffering, which puts a completely different spin on it. So the one who seeks enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, these are the practices. So they're not cold. They're not just, you know, you just don't go off into a corner somewhere. They're the kind of thing you ask every day, in every moment, in every interaction, in every relationship. So that it becomes a matter of a heart opening and not just the mind opening. For most people, the mind opens first, and then they have to make this incredibly long journey from here to here. It's the longest 12 inches you'll ever traverse. Some people are open here, right? They become healers and helpers and all sorts of things. But without this, they get burnt out. They get left behind. They deprive themselves of stuff. This has got to be a flow between wisdom and compassion. This is the flow this way, and there's the flow this way.